Good morning. There we go. That's a little bit better. My name's Nathan. For those of you guys who are new, I'm the pastor here at Genesis Boyne. And welcome to our series that we're calling, well, that did not go quite like I expected. And the idea for this series, it really came from the fact that we have an unfortunate tendency to kind of become, oh, Bible, ho-hum, no big deal. It's like, you know, Jesus brought Lazarus back from the dead, and you're like, oh, yeah, well, doctors can do that, too. Okay, I got you there. But do they generally do it after the person's been dead for 4 days? Do they do it after the person has already been put in the tomb? Do they do it, like, out of which doctor do you know that actually does it by saying, hey, Lazarus, don't be dead anymore, and then he just pops back up? That's what I thought. Like, we have come a long way in medicine, don't get me wrong. But that's not medicine. That is a miracle that shows the power of God. We have to be able to understand and discern the difference for that. And the goal for this series really is for us to look at events like that and be able to see the amazing and life-changing stories that they are. For them to be able to affect us, for us to be able to look at them and realize and be a part of them, just see them afresh. So as you know, Jesus has entered the ministry scene, and he is now a major celebrity. He's got thousands of people who are following him. And like most celebrities, athletes and actors and musicians, Jesus has a posse. He's got like his crew, he's got his entourage that follows him around. And for Jesus, this is the disciples. But obviously, before you can have disciples, you need to find your disciples first. And that brings us to Luke 5. That one day, Jesus was preaching on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Great crowds, they were pressing in on him to listen to the word of God. So he looked, and he noticed two empty boats at the water's edge, for the fishermen had left, they were washing their nets. Stepping into one of the boats, Jesus asked Simon, this is a.k.a. Peter, that's his other name. So Jesus asked Simon Peter, its owner, to push it out into the water. Then he sat in the boat, and he taught the crowds from there. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, now, I need you to go out where it's deeper, let down your nets, and you catch some fish. Master, we worked hard all last night, and we didn't catch a single thing. I think you guys probably are familiar with this feeling. Out of curiosity, raise your hand. How many of you guys feel like you are good at least something in your lives? Okay, so most of us feel like we are competent at least one thing. Now, the follow-up question, raise your hands. How many of you guys get a little bit annoyed when somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about gives you advice on the thing that you're good at? The same amount of people, exactly. So you know how Peter feels. Peter is a fisherman. That means morning, noon, night. Peter spends his whole day fishing. That's all he does. So put yourself in Peter's place at this point. Some joker comes up. And like, Peter does not know that Jesus is the Son of God at this point. He's just some teacher who borrowed his boat. So some joker comes up, he starts giving you advice on something you're an expert in. You're thinking, here's the thing, buddy. I'm sure you're a good teacher, but you stick to your day job, I'll do the fishing. And you can kind of see that a little bit in his reply. Master, we worked hard all night and we didn't catch a thing. Right, but if you say so, I'll let the nets down again. And at this time, their nets were so full of fish that they began to tear. So they shout, help! And it brought their partners from in the other boat. And soon both the boats were filled with fish, and they're on the verge of sinking. When Simon Peter realized what had happened, he fell to his knees before Jesus. And he said, Lord, please, please leave me. I am such a sinful man. For he was awestruck by the number of fish they had caught, as were the others with them, his partners James and John. They're the sons of Zebedee. They were also amazed. And the thing that I love, like reading these verses, the thing that I love about Peter always wears his heart on his sleeve. You don't have to guess what his emotions are. They have a tendency to just come right out of his mouth. So this whole encounter, Peter's got this attitude, and then you can see it dynamically shift, that he's like, hold on a second. Now, if Jesus is the real deal, oh, no. No, 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 no. Stay away from me. No, back up. You do not want to be near me. You don't know who I. You don't know what I have done. Please stay away from me. I've got to get out. I cannot be in the presence of somebody like that. I'm too messed up. And I think we've all been there at some point. I mean, that's my response when I look at an all-powerful, all-knowing, majestic, loving God. It makes me feel pathetic. It makes me feel inadequate. I can't measure up to that. And now all of a sudden he's here, he's talking to me, he's loving on me. Like, how do you process that? Like, why? Here's how Jesus replies to that thought. You don't have to be afraid. This is verse 11. Don't be afraid. From now on, you'll be fishing for people. And as soon as they landed, they left everything and they followed Jesus. I'm going to say that again. At that moment, they left everything. The Bible doesn't say, well, they left a few things. It doesn't say, no, they left some of their things that they didn't really care about. It doesn't say they left most of their stuff, but they kept five or six really valuable pieces. They had a boat full of fish. They just turned around and walked away from it. They left everything to follow Jesus. And a question that we can ask ourselves is, if Jesus said, all right, come, follow me, are you really willing to do that? What's the toughest thing that you might have to leave? If you're having to leave everything, are you willing to do that? And this is a huge step forward for the disciples in their faith, in their following of Christ. They leave everything. And it's not long before a few more people who had also left everything, they also decide, hey, you know, I'd kind of like to follow Jesus. It brings us to chapter 6, that one day, soon afterwards, Jesus went on a mountain to pray. And he prayed to God all night. And at daybreak, he called together all of his disciples, and he chose 12 of them to be apostles. And here are their names. Simon, who he named Peter. He's got Andrew, Peter's brother, James and John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, who's the son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who was the one who later betrayed him. And you're like, cool, found his disciples, right? Actually, wrong. This is a major mistake. Like, Jesus is making a super rookie move here. And I can prove it to you. I've said this a couple of times, but this is another clear case that Jesus just does not know what he's doing. So I'm going to have you guys take a few seconds, and I'm going to have you think about a question. So here's the scenario. You're starting up a business or a group, and you want this group to be the living representative of you for the future. You want this group of people to be your legacy, okay? The question is, what type of people are you going to choose to have the best chance at success? I want you guys to think of three or four types of people and just answer that question. What type of people would you choose to represent you so that your legacy can have the best chance at long-term success? I'm going to give you guys about 30 seconds. Think about two or three, four types of people. So here's, I don't have time to ask everybody their teams, but here's my ideal team. First thing I want on my team, I want some smart people. I want some well-educated people, people who can think through the problems that might come up, who can make sure that it's well written, that they're just good, smart people that make sure that it's well put together. I'm also going to want, my second group of people I want some rich people. I want people who've got the money to support this. Make the commercials, write the books, build the product. I need people who can financially get this out there. So I'm going to need some good, wealthy donors. Third group of people that I want some well-spoken people. I need some people who are going to be able to get out and talk to the audience, talk to the congregation, do commercials, be those eloquent speakers who can really get out there and just tell people about it, and people are like, okay, yeah, I'm totally in for that. And the last group of people that I thought of would be well-respected people. I want people who are people of influence, people of power, people, mayors or governors or actors or different celebrities that can, when they say it, oh man, yeah, he says that, I'm totally interested in that. That's my ideal team. I'm guessing yours are probably similar. You've got some things in common there. I feel like I put together a team like that. I feel like my legacy's going to go places. Now I want you to look at what Jesus did. The list of disciples Jesus puts together. And it is the living embodiment of, that is not quite what I expected. Uneducated people, bunch of fishermen, bunch of just common tradesmen. Not dumb people, uneducated people. People who didn't go to college and get their master's and their doctorate. Generally poor people, working class people. People who didn't have the money to just support this entire thing. You continually see that come up. They didn't have the money to be able to do certain amounts of things. Non-eloquent people. None of them were versed in getting up and speaking. Disrespected people, specifically the tax collectors. But your working class were generally looked down upon in general. The tax collectors were the lowliest of the low. You might as well have just hired a bunch of serial killers to be your disciples. Like, they are really, really, really disliked. That is the exact opposite of the list of people that we want on our team. And honestly, that's probably about the worst people you could get to represent you, right? It's crazy to me that Jesus chooses these guys as his disciples. And it's equally crazy to me that Jesus is still choosing the same type of people today. I am living proof of that right here. I was trying to think of a good example, and then I realized it was me. Like, why does God have me up here representing him through speaking? I don't know if you've noticed this, but I'm a little bit weird. And there were gasps in the crowd. Spoiler alert, guys, for those of you who are new. I am not educated in speaking. I have never taken a class in this. I am awkward. I am an introvert. I came into this town with zero reputation. Nobody knew me from anybody. But Jesus, in his love, he called the disciples there and they followed. And Jesus, in his love, he called me here today and I followed. Personal advice for you. When Jesus calls, follow it. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I'm saying it's going to be worth it. Let's flash forward a couple of chapters. He's chosen his disciples. Let's see how this whole disciple thing is playing itself out. Luke 8. One day, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's cross to the other side of the lake." So they got in their boat and they started out. And as they sailed across, Jesus settled down for a nap. And soon a fierce storm came down on the lake. The boat was filling with water and they were in real danger. Now, for those of you who have not been to Israel before, the Sea of Galilee is actually about the size of Lake Charlevoix. So you have a pretty good barometer of how big it is. So what I want you guys to do is, I want you to close your eyes. And I promise you, I am not going to scare you this time. Nobody's going to jump out for those of you who were here last time. I'm not going to scare you this time. Close your eyes. Imagine you're on a boat in Lake Charlevoix. And you see a few clouds. And a few clouds start to turn into a little bit of it's raining, it's a little bit of a storm. All of a sudden, you realize it's starting to get worse. But it's okay. You don't have to worry. You're with professional sailors, and they do this for a living. So it's getting even worse, and they're starting to look a little bit panicked. And now all of a sudden, you're starting to get lightning and thunder and waves, and it's getting louder, and it's getting louder, and you can hardly hear yourself. And it's thunder and lightning, and wind is howling, and you're afraid you're going to start to drown before you get to the shore. People are screaming. They're trying to figure out if they're bailing water. You're scared to death, and you're wondering, what in the world are we going to do? And the disciples realize what they've got to do. They go, and they shout, "Master, Master, we are going to drown." And Jesus wakes up, and he rebukes the wind, and he rebukes the wave, and suddenly the storm stops. And Jesus looks at the disciples and he asks, "Where is your faith?" And the disciples were terrified. They said, "Who is this man?" They asked each other, who's the man who can give a command and even the wind and the waves obey him?" You guys can open your eyes. There's two questions that happen there. Two questions that are asked in this last verse. The first one is, where is your faith? And it harkens back to a couple of weeks ago. A couple of weeks ago where you see the extreme faith of a Roman officer. He'd never seen Jesus in his life, but he knows the power of Christ. And Jesus says, man, you've got some tremendous, tremendous faith. Now you see the flip side of that. When it comes to his own disciples, this guy had never seen Christ. These guys see Jesus every single day. And Jesus finds himself asking, where's your faith? The second question that comes up is, who is this guy? And you got to be baffled. You're like, come on, guys, you know this. You have seen him silence demons. You have seen him catch impossible amounts of fish. You've seen him turn water into wine. You've seen him heal hundreds of people. Why are you not getting this? But then, don't we find ourselves doing the exact same thing? I mean, are we really that different? All God does for us, and I continually have people come and talk to me, and they're like, does God really care? I don't feel like he's going to be there for me this time. I don't know. I don't even know if he exists anymore. 2,000 years later, we're doing the same things. So again, for the disciples, you look at this. It's a huge step forward. They took the faith, step of faith. They left everything. Now all of a sudden, they're taking this huge step back. How little faith. They don't know who God is. But fortunately, Jesus doesn't give up on them, just like he doesn't give up on us. And after some further teaching, Jesus felt it was finally time. It's time to send the disciples out on a little test run. You know, push the little birdies out of the nest. So in chapter 9, one day Jesus, he calls together his 12 disciples and he gave them power and authority to cast out all demons and heal all diseases. Then he sent them out to tell everyone about the kingdom and to heal the sick. Now, take nothing for your journey. Don't take a walking stick, a traveler's bag, food, money, or even a change of clothes. Wherever you go, stay in the same house until you leave town. And if a town refuses to welcome you, you shake the dust from your feet as you leave to show you've abandoned those people to their fate. So they began to circuit the villages, preaching the good news and healing the sick. And when the apostles returned, they told Jesus about everything they had done. I put myself in this place. Like, this is such an exciting time for me. Like, I'm one of the disciples and I'm thinking, you think we're ready? You really think we're ready? Yeah, sweet. Like, I'm ready. Let's go. Come on. John, all right, you come with me. I mean, yeah, I'm a little embarrassed about the whole boat incident, but let's not talk about that anymore. Jesus is ready for me. Let's go. And it goes really well. They come back. Like, we come back. We're bursting with pride. We're bursting with energy and excitement. And it's like, Jesus, man, you are not going to believe this. It was so awesome. You should have been there. Thomas healed this dude. He had a broken arm. And the whole family wants to follow you now. Like, come on. This is going to be fun. And you're going, all right, the disciples are getting it. They're finally ready. They're healing people. They're preaching the word. They're ready to go conquer the world for Christ. Until we get to the next verse. And the crowds find out where Jesus was going, and they followed him, and he welcomed them. He taught them about the kingdom of God, and he healed those who were sick. And late in the afternoon, the disciples came up to him, and they said, Jesus, you need to send the crowds away to nearby villages and farms so they can find food and lodging for the night. There's nothing here to eat in this remote place. And Jesus said, you feed them. But we only have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Or are you expecting us to go and buy enough food for this whole crowd? For there were about 5,000 men there. Now remember, these are the same disciples that the previous verse had just come back from casting out demons and healing people themselves with the power of God. They have the power given to them by Jesus in person. So Jesus gives them their next test. Feed these people. And I want you guys to look at something. This is, by the way, this is food. Like, at this point, anything that I do, you guys are not surprised. Like, if there was like a box of snakes under here, you wouldn't overly be surprised. But this is what they have. This is, oh, hold on. This is 5 loaves and 2 fish. That's what they got. That's what they're looking at here. Practical example. This is what the disciples had. Now, you guys are smart. You can do the math. You can look at this room and realize how many people you think this is going to feed. It's not going to feed this room. We'll all get a nibble, but we're not getting full off of it. You think it's going to feed 5,000 people? And by the way, if anybody wants to try this, I will give this to you. You can take it out. You can try to feed the entirety of Boyne City today. Like, that's an intimidating thought. So Jesus gives it to the disciples. Ew, gross. All right. So Jesus says this to the disciples, and they're just like, And I really don't believe this was some cruel exercise on Jesus' part to teach them a lesson. I really believe Jesus knows they can do it. All the disciples have to do is take the next step of faith. Believe Jesus and go for it. But they look at it, and they just can't do it. After another huge step of faith, they go forward. They're healing. They're preaching the kingdom. It's another step back. Verse 14, Jesus replied, "All right, tell them to sit down in groups of about 50 each." So all the people sat down, and Jesus took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and he looked up to heaven and he blessed them. Then, breaking the loaves into pieces, he gave the bread and fish to the disciples so they could distribute it to the people. And they all ate as much as they wanted. And afterwards, the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftovers. And that's the thing. They didn't all have a nibble. They all were full, and there were 12 baskets left over. Which, by the way, this is one of the stories, every time I read this afresh, I really try to clear my mind. I always wonder about the schematics of this miracle. I don't know if you guys have done this, but I always do. Like, was it a bottomless bread basket that was kind of like a clown car that they just kept pulling out, and it was there, and it was there? Like, did he keep putting his hands behind his back, and it was like, ta-da, 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 like, was he ripping it in half and it was magically restoring? I don't know. This is like a fascinating thing for me to try to imagine. It's a little look into my mind. And out of any story in the Bible, this is one of the ones that I can't wait to see when I get to heaven and they have like a big screen and we do a replay of Jesus' whole life. Like, I am excited about seeing how this plays itself out. Also, secondly, if Jesus did this miracle today, it'd probably turn out less like a miracle and more a little bit like this. That is so 2018. It's like, oh my goodness, I don't even know what to do with you guys. But seriously, like, this miracle is flabbergasting. Like, imagine you're one of the 12 disciples, and you're like, Peter, why is Jesus asking us to do this? Peter's like, I don't know. We gave up everything. Remember that verse a few chapters ago? We gave up the house, the clothes, the money. We gave it all up, but we can't afford to pay for this. Jesus hands you a basket, and you're thinking, all right. I guess I'll hand them out to the first 3 people, and then I don't know what we're going to do after that. You, and where is all this coming from? And then 2,000 people later, you're like, seriously, where is all this bread coming from? I also love that there were 12 baskets left over. You see any symmetry there? There's one for each of the doubting disciples who gets to carry it with them for the next week and eat out of it as they start to ask that question or continue to ask that question, who is this guy? And it's a question that actually comes up in the very next verse. One day, Jesus left the crowds to pray alone, and only his disciples were with him. So he asked, who do people say that I am? Well, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah. Others say you're one of the ancient prophets risen from the dead. Then he asked them, but who do you say that I am? And if I'm reading this afresh, if I don't know what's happening, I'm kind of nervous for the disciples. I mean, we're 9 chapters into this thing, and the disciples are, I mean, they could say anything at this point, and I genuinely would not be surprised. But Peter replies, verse 20, you're the Messiah sent from God. And I'm like, yes, that's a note of triumph. Finally, somebody gets it. Like maybe, just maybe, we're on the right path to something good. So I start thinking about us. You can start thinking, all right, so like, where does this leave us? We're 2,000 years later. I think much like the Pharisees last week, we can see ourselves mirrored in the disciples. There are spiritual walks. They're two steps forward and a step back and one step forward and three steps back. And all of a sudden, you're doing this little dance with God. You're just going forwards and backwards and forwards. But I find these stories comforting. And I hope you do too, that we can look at these stories and realize we don't have to have this inferiority complex. Because you look and you go, man, I am not Paul. I'm not Peter. I'm not John. But guys, you are. Just like them, we are disciples of Christ. And it's pretty clear from these stories, the disciples didn't just instantly get it. They didn't meet Jesus and start running 1,000 miles an hour. They started, they crawled, they walked, they stumbled, they fell, and they got back up and they did it again. That's our walks with God here. Fortunately, when we mess up, when we fall, he doesn't leave us. When we fall, he loves us. And that's what we can walk away with from today. That, yeah, we're going to struggle, just like the disciples did. But when we do fall, we have a God who is there for us. We have a God who will say, it's okay. Let me help you up. I've got your back. I love you. Let's do this together.